It's the Burt Cohen Show. Is the dream? Is it created by the mainstream, or sometimes does it have to be pushed a little bit, maybe not so little bit, by people at the edges? You've probably heard of Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, maybe the name rings a bell. If you listen to this show regularly, you probably do know who Noam Chomsky is. He has been a guest on this show a couple of times, and he's a linguistics professor, but he's known more for other influences that he may have had on American culture and politics. Well, we're going to be talking about Noam Chomsky today, his influence and how influential he has been, and perhaps looking a little bit critically at a person who, to many people on the left, he is kind of a hero. Our guest today is Tony Greco, author of a brand new book called Chomsky's Challenge to American Power. Tony, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, Tony Greco is an independent scholar. He's received his PhD in political science from Columbia and then had a 35-year career in financial, business, and public policy analysis in the public and private sectors. Greco is an associate of Columbia University Seminar on 20th Century Politics and Society. And his new book, Chomsky's Challenge to American Power, is put out by Vanderbilt University Press. This book is said to be the first to take Noam Chomsky seriously while treating him critically. Well, let's start out with, who is Noam Chomsky for people who may not be familiar with that name?
Okay, well, as I think you alluded, he is a giant in the field of linguistics. He is, I think, probably generally recognized as the major figure in 20th century linguistics, but he's more widely known as a public intellectual, as a critic of American politics and foreign policy. He first took up that role during the Vietnam War in the 1960s, and he's been playing that role ever since.
And he has written a lot. Noam Chomsky has written a tremendous amount. There's no lack of words that he has put on paper and into the broadcast realm. What was your purpose, Tony, in writing this book? What was the need for this book to be written?
Well, a couple of things. It just happens that the stuff that Chomsky has talked about and written about over the last 50 years very much coincides with my old long-standing interests. He wrote about the Cold War and America's motivations for pursuing its Cold War policies. He wrote about Vietnam, obviously. He wrote about the media and its role in shaping our consciousness and especially in mobilizing acquiescence in our foreign policies. He wrote about the role of the intellectuals. Chomsky was just, for me, a very, very good vehicle for exploring a number of important issues that meant a lot to me. But I was also aware that Chomsky was a very controversial figure. Nobody really had looked at Chomsky in what you might call a balanced and objective way. I mean, there are people who think that Chomsky is terrific and practically beyond criticism, and there are people who think that Chomsky is awful and dismissible and not worth paying any attention to. I felt that there was a need for a book that looked at Chomsky and brought out what was valuable and valid in his work, but that also acknowledged his shortcomings. And I think nobody else has done that.
Interesting. I admit it. I acknowledge it proudly. I admire Chomsky. I admire what he's done. Where where were you coming from when you set out to write this book? Did you expect at the beginning to end up with kind of a mixed review of his work, or did you expect to be, pretty much just positive about him?
I guess I suspected I would have a mixed reaction. I wasn't sure. I just didn't know. I hadn't really read much Chomsky since the Vietnam War. I was a young man during the Vietnam War. I read his essays on Vietnam, which I really loved at the time. Then for decades, I hadn't read any Chomsky, except I had just read his book on the Middle East, maybe in the 1990s. So I really wasn't sure where I'd come out. But from fragmentary things that I'd seen about Chomsky, I was guessing that probably there was a mixed picture here, and it was worth filling out.
And certainly, he had a great influence on my generation as well. We may be of similar age. I was 14 in 1965 when the war was really starting to get going. And,
yeah, we're close.
Yeah, and he's had a very, very big influence on that. And he's written a lot about the Middle East as well, which is where he's gotten in some, trouble on the left. There are some people who tend, frankly, to be of an older generation who feel like, Israel can do no wrong. We can't criticize Israel, the state of Israel. He has not shied away from that. What can you tell us about, his getting into a little bit of trouble with some of his natural allies when it comes to the Middle East?
I think you're right. Jews have made a tremendous contribution to our intellectual life, and a substantial portion of the American intellectual community is Jewish or interested in Jewish concerns. And I think Chomsky's very harsh attitudes towards Israel probably helped turn people away from him, starting in the 1970s.
Yeah, it seems to be the case. Now, he makes his living, as far as I know. I don't think he makes money from politics except from writing books. But he's a professor of linguistics at MIT. I'm not sure. Could his politics be related to his depth of knowledge of linguistics, to his skills and knowledge regarding an understanding of linguistics, somehow inform his foreign policy critique or his style of communicating, maybe? I'm trying to see if there's any connection at all.
Yeah, it's a natural question. Chomsky has said that there's really no direct connection between his linguistics work and his political work, and I take him at his word on that. Still, I think a constant feature of his political work is an attention to language and the uses and abuses of language, especially in rationalizing American power. For example, he looks at words like terror and terrorism and asks about the meaning that we ascribe to it. And he points out that the conventional definition of terrorism involves actions by non-state actors, typically enemies of the United States. But he asks, there should be a broader understanding of what terror can do. Terror may well be the result of state action. Like, the United States certainly employed terror when it bombed Vietnamese villages in free fire zones during the war in the 1960s. It employed terror against the Sandinista regime in the 1980s, Sandinistas in Nicaragua. So he's constantly looking at how we use language and use it as in an ideological way to influence the way we think about politics.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. I mean, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist.
That's right. Ronald Reagan called the Sandinistas freedom fighters, but arguably, I certainly agree with Chomsky, they were terrorists.
You mean the Contras were the freedom fighters under Reagan, and the Sandinistas were so-called terrorists under. But you're right. I mean, just getting into this discussion shows the power of language. How things, the idea of patriotism. We have the Patriot Act, which many people certainly could call not particularly patriotic to the sense of freedom and democracy that America has, but that's what it's called, in the power of language. So
absolutely. Language frames the way we think about politics, and Chomsky is always attentive to this. So even if his rather sort of inaccessible and might be regarded as arcane theories of linguistics aren't directly related to his political analysis, there seems to be some relationship there.
Yeah, I think so. If you just tuned into the Bert Cohen Show, my guest today is Tony Greco, author of the new book Chomsky's Challenge to American Power, a guide for the critical reader. Chomsky first came onto the world political stage with his critiques of the American war in Vietnam. In 1967, rather, he wrote a paper called The Responsibility of Intellectuals, which some say became the most important essay of the Vietnam generation. Now, at the time, most liberals in America saw American policy as well-intentioned, that we were trying to defend the free democratic government of the Republic of Vietnam against the northern invaders. But so most liberals at the time he wrote this saw our policy as well-intentioned, but we just had a bad client government that we needed to change that government. How central or symbolic did Chomsky see the war in Vietnam in the context of overall U.S. foreign policy?
I think probably he was just forming a notion of a broader understanding of U.S. foreign policy, and it took him perhaps a little bit of time to place Vietnam in context, which he eventually did. I mean, he saw our war in Vietnam as part of a broader effort to maintain a kind of dominance of the world for the purposes of advancing the interests of American business. I mean, that's basically been his explanation of U.S. foreign policy going way back, that our government basically seeks to make the world safe for American business. And the Vietnam revolt, the revolt in South Vietnam, threatened an important part of the American economic empire. And I think he saw that, he started seeing that from a fairly early point.
And it's interesting how, again, looking at the use of language, I just think about the word freedom. And when we see people like Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush talk about freedom, I understand what they mean to be freedom for American businesses to do whatever they want, wherever they want, without constraint. And that is the limits of the word freedom for those people. And I think they meant it quite sincerely. Now, freedom to me and you, I think, means a little bit more than that. But it's so interesting how you frame things. Chomsky's 67 critique, you know, the responsibility of intellectuals, how was that seen at the time? And how is it seen today?
Well, I can tell you how I saw it at the time, because I remember. I remember reading that essay and thinking it was wonderful, that it was saying what I had been thinking but not quite articulating clearly, because I was very much aware. I was studying political science. I was very much aware that political scientists typically, at least initially, were supportive of the war.
Yes.
And Chomsky was saying that intellectuals, because of their skills, their knowledge, their ability to understand, have a special responsibility to tell it like it is. I mean, you perhaps might not blame the general population for not understanding what was going on, but you can blame intellectuals. They deserve to be blamed. They have a responsibility to tell the truth as he saw it. And he was particularly critical of claims that expertise excluded the general population from understanding what was going on. Typically, he would encounter protests from defenders of the war who would say, "What do you know? You're a linguist. You can't understand what's really going on. You have to listen to the experts." And Chomsky made the argument that, well, the experts were biased. There was a long history, well, not a long history, but a history of complicity with the war machine, with American foreign policy, that naturally biased intellectuals, particularly in the social sciences, to be supportive of the war. And I thought he made a very, very powerful critique.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're bringing back memories here that back then it was, oh, the people don't know. The president knows so much more. We got to trust the experts, the
right
people who know more than you and me, just hand it over to them. And a lot of the intellectuals at the time were part of the war-making machine. They were, you know, helping to create it. They were involved in, you know, weapons development, for example, and, you know, targeting and things like that. So he, it sounds like what you're saying, that Chomsky was saying that intellectuals can't, I mean, they can simply be in the service of official government policy, but they have a broader responsibility. Is that right?
Yes. I think we often think of intellectuals as, in a sense, potentially at least dissidents, as mm-hmm. critical of their culture, and often that's the case. But it you can't assume that. Frequently, intellectuals, just like ordinary people, are worldly people. They are vulnerable to the temptations of prestige and wealth and position that the ordinary people are attracted to. And when the federal government and the broader society make it worthwhile for intellectuals to be supportive of the prevailing orthodoxies, many intellectuals will answer that call.
Yeah, they see which side their bread is buttered on.
Right.
and, you know, certainly Chomsky is not the only one who had, you know, an analysis of the U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the initial reaction of most liberals was, yeah, Vietnam, we're on the right side. It's just we got to fine-tune it a little bit. But he described it, as did Howard Zinn, for that matter, as being totally within the context of you know, U.S. business interests. How vital to a left critique, now that all these years have passed, over 40 years, really, hard to believe, but how vital to a left critique of U.S. foreign policy is Noam Chomsky, seen in the light of history and all this time passing?
Well, I think he supplies us with part of the answer. I mean, he really focuses quite exclusively on business interests and business power as the motive force for American foreign policy. I think that's part of the explanation, but I think it's only part, and Chomsky tends to neglect the other things. For example, certainly during the Cold War, anti-communist ideology was very real. I mean, we were a society pervaded by a sort of an obsession with anti-communism,
yeah.
And that obsession was shared by policymakers, by ordinary people, by intellectuals. It wasn't phony. I mean, at one point, Chomsky has said that the fear of communism was always a total fraud. Well, I think that's a huge overstatement. I think it was real, and it was part of the reason for why we went into Vietnam.
Yes.
It was an exaggerated fear, but it wasn't a total fraud. I think also large, powerful entities like the American, what you might call the American Empire, simply want to reproduce their power. Power tends to want to reproduce itself and maintain itself.
So I've noticed.
So the sheer self-maintenance and institutional self-interest of this vast empire is part of the explanation for why the American foreign policy has been as assertive of its right to world primacy as it has been. It's not just, I don't think, an economic thing. It's not just a reflection of business interests. It's a reflection of a war machine, you might say, of a foreign policy machine that is, again, widely shared. People believe that American power is good for the world, and then that's an assumption that mm-hmm. is, I think, pervasive in our society.
Yeah, it's interesting to perhaps simplify everything as just we're doing for business interests. I remember when some people grabbed on when President Eisenhower mentioned in passing that there was tungsten in the area of Indochina back in the 50s. People thought, oh, it's all about the business interests. But
right.
There's also an intangible called, as you mentioned, it's just macho power, power, power. You're just hungry for power. There's no necessarily logical explanation for it. You write that critics view Noam Chomsky as a propagandist and ideologue who, as we're discussing, sees only black and white where there are multiple shades of gray. Is this true? Is it is that actually accurate, that he does see things in black and white when there really are multiple shades of gray?
I think it's often the case. I could give you lots of examples of Chomsky's sort of oversimplifying the issues and basically looking at just one side of the story. I think Chomsky is very good for giving you a side of the story that you won't typically find in the media. But if you're looking for a really balanced account of an issue, Chomsky is not that good. I could give lots of examples.
Sure.
Let's just take the first Gulf War, 1990, 1991.
Right.
The United States, with UN authorization, has just kicked Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that war, Saddam Hussein was facing revolts within his own country, from his own people, and he put them down with characteristic brutality.
Yes.
Chomsky has written in several places that the United States authorized Saddam Hussein to put down those revolts.
Hmm.
In one place he says flatly, we authorized Saddam Hussein to do that. In other places he said we effectively or implicitly authorized Saddam Hussein.
Hmm.
Now, why is he saying that? I mean, it's not true. I mean, there was no authorization from Washington, to Saddam Hussein. But he's saying that because the United States didn't step in and help the rebels in their fight against Saddam Hussein. But there are huge reasons for not doing that, which Chomsky doesn't even discuss. I mean, he doesn't even refer to them. I mean, would it not have gotten us embroiled, threatened to get us embroiled in a civil war with no end? It would certainly have violated international law. Chomsky is always an advocate of international law. But to go in without UN authorization, we would have been overstepping the UN limit. And a lot of countries were suspicious that the United States was using its intervention in the Kuwait controversy as a power grab. So we would have aroused a lot of suspicion around the world if we had gone in and helped the rebels. But all these considerations against helping the rebels, some of them rather similar to the reasons why many of us opposed intervention in Syria last year.
Mm.
All of these reasons Chomsky ignored. He just simply says, we didn't help the rebels. That means that we were authorizing Saddam Hussein to crush them. It's clearly a vast oversimplification of a very complicated set of issues.
Hmm. I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotes from H.L. Mencken, I believe it was, who said, to every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's wrong.
Yes, that's very good.
And it was certainly complex. I mean, I wonder what he said, frankly, I don't remember, about the when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990-1991. My guess would be his sort of knee-jerk reaction would be to say, oh, the U.S. is wrong. I mean, that tends to be, his default location where he goes. But, you know, the fact is Iraq did invade Kuwait, which I guess at one point had been part of Iraq. But it's sometimes more complicated than that. And you know, there's a lot of gray. Are there other examples, Tony, of where you see Chomsky overstating, simplifying, or ignoring evidence which just does not suit his chosen analysis?
Well, sure. Let me give you just another example. This goes way back. In 1954, the United States basically engineered a coup that overthrew a leftist regime in Guatemala. Chomsky talks about that, and he cites one source which estimates that in the months following the coup, about 7,500 people were killed. Dissidents, members of the past government, leftists and so forth. And he's right in citing that source, 7,500 people. That's the number that was given in that particular source. But there's another source, another book written by an impeccably left-oriented scholar, a guy named McClintock, in which he explains carefully why he thinks the numbers are only 300 or 400 or 500. He explains, to my mind, very credibly, why the number is low. Chomsky is familiar with McClintock's book. He certainly read that explanation because he cites McClintock repeatedly. But he doesn't mention this low estimate of the number of deaths. He only mentions the number, the 7,500 number. Now, a fair and honest way of reporting this issue would have been at least to say estimates of the number of deaths range from the low hundreds to 7,500. But he didn't say that. He just ignored McClintock. And as I say, there's no way he didn't know that McClintock had written that. He couldn't have just missed it.
Hmm. So in a way, that what you're talking about there might validate the critique of him as a propagandist and an ideologue.
Well, you know, I think it's a little harsh. Propaganda has a very negative sound.
Oh, yeah.
He is, I use the term advocate. He's clearly an advocate for a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't necessarily give you all the sides of the story that you might be interested in.
Hmm. Interesting. Again, you're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. Our guest today is Anthony Greco, author of the new book, Chomsky's Challenge to American Power. Chomsky is certainly a contrarian, and I imagine he kind of likes being a contrarian. Does he ever play the contrarian role with too much enthusiasm for his own goals?
That might be the case. I think the contrarian role is variable. I mean, he will point out things that others might not point out because they're unpopular positions. For example, he pointed out in 1993 or 1994, the United States claimed that Saddam Hussein had tried to kill the former President Bush, and we implemented some reprisal strikes. The evidence that Saddam Hussein had really been involved in that assassination attempt was really quite thin. But it was hardly ever questioned in the media. But Chomsky, you know, brought it out. Here he is playing the role of contrarian, where few other people would want to sort of seem to be defending Saddam Hussein. But I do think, I think Chomsky enjoys being provocative. And that may be part of the reason why people react against him. I mean, the provocation is maybe easily cheered by his supporters, but repelled by his foes.
Yeah, and certainly there's, I mean, you look throughout history, we've always needed provocateurs, people who provoke. It's absolutely essential to make real historical change. Now, there are also other parts of historical dynamics aside from that, but that is which are also necessary, but that's a necessary component. I wonder if there might be times in your analysis, Tony, in which Chomsky has what he might even consider to be lapses in intellectual rigor. I mean, his intellectual rigor is what carries him, what gives him the gravitas to keep going. Has he had, do you think, serious lapses in intellectual rigor?
Has he acknowledged any on his own part?
Well, has he acknowledged any, and do you see any?
I don't think he's acknowledged any. I do see plenty. I mean, the kinds of things that I just mentioned,
just ignoring,
not giving a full reporting of the available sources on casualties in Guatemala, the very very one sided statement of the situation in Iraq in 1991. That kind of thing recurs over and over again. I could give you many more examples. It might be tedious, but for example, in the 1990s, Turkey was waging a rather nasty counterinsurgency campaign against its Kurdish minority, which Chomsky criticized rightly and pointed out that the United States, Turkey's ally, had not done really anything to restrain Turkey. But Chomsky, without any evidence, claims that the United States was behind Turkey's escalation of its war in 1993. He says this was the preference of the United States. He doesn't explain why the United States should have preferred that, or he doesn't explain what his basis is for this claim. He doesn't offer any evidence. As far as I can see, there is none. He's just assuming that the worst about the United States, which is what he wants to assume. Similarly, he makes the claim that no one else would have been selling arms to the Turks the way the United States was selling arms. But his main source on this whole issue, John Terman, a political scientist at MIT, says that other countries, Germany and France and Britain, were ready and willing and happy to sell arms to the Turks if the United States wasn't going to sell them. So here he's making a claim that directly contradicts the information provided by his main source for the issue. And at the very least, one would expect him to give evidence for his counterclaim, but he doesn't. I can't help suspecting that he just, again,
well,
was pulling it out of thin air.
One of the, you know, as a former elective office holder, I can, from my experience, it seems that part of the necessary growth as either an intellectual or a politician is to recognize new information which may shed new light from a different angle on things we believed, which the new information may show that it was erroneous. Do you have examples of how he's actually gotten, you know, new dissonant information, and then how he's dealt with the information? Has he incorporated it and you know, allowed that to influence what he said, or does he just consistently ignore new information? That would, you know, say something about his intellectual rigor.
Well, I think he has sometimes revisited issues when new information was available and was able to fill in some of the details. Another occasion, for example, in Indonesia, he talked about the coup in Indonesia in 1965 that resulted in the deaths of possibly over a million people.
Right.
The deaths which were engineered and supervised by the government that came into power.
Mm-hmm. So he has.
He didn't have all the information then. He made some pretty good hunches, and he was mostly right. And you know, eventually he was able to fill in some of the blanks. But I don't think Chomsky is particularly good at admitting to error, even in the face of new information. And the big case here, and this I think was very important in influencing people's perceptions of Chomsky, was Cambodia in the 1970s. As you know, right. In 1975, a communist government came to power in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, and very soon afterwards implemented a campaign of quasi-genocidal proportions.
Yes.
And Chomsky initially, with a co-author, Edward Herman, basically disparaged reports of mass atrocities by the Cambodian communists. I think Chomsky was... wanted to believe that this was a real revolution, a genuine liberating event, and the American media were just engaged in their usual propagandistic effort to put down revolutionaries. Eventually, the information became overwhelming, and it became clear, and Chomsky certainly acknowledges that, yes, there were mass murders, perhaps 2 million people out of a population of 8 million killed.
Yeah.
But he claims retrospectively not to have said anything wrong. He gives you the impression almost that he had known about it all along. He's never admitted to error over Cambodia. And I think if he had, his credibility would have suffered a lot less than it has as a result of that whole episode.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, credibility is... I would think a man of his position, the most important thing you have is your credibility, being an intellectual and being, you know, being out there for so long. The left, you know, in the United States, the currently United States, the left has, we've been notoriously divided. An old friend, Abby Hoffman, said, isms get schisms and go to wasms pretty quick, and the relationship between the left and the right is perfect. The left is masochistic, the right is sadistic. That being said, is it true that the left has been divided with regard to appreciation of Chomsky as well? Is his critique pretty much the mainstream of left foreign policy analysis and suggestions, or have there been, I mean, how is... Is he sort of the standard on for the left critique of U.S. foreign policy?
That's hard to say. Obviously, it depends on how you define the left.
True.
There's a moderate left which tends to be dovish and critical of the excessive use of brutality and force in American foreign policy. I mean, lots of people on the moderate left were very critical of the Bush administration and its unilateralism, and especially the attack on Iraq in
2003.
But they don't share the kind of really fundamental, radically critical view of American foreign policy that Chomsky espouses. I think there are gradations. There are people who are not that different from Chomsky and his views of American foreign policy. For example, Andrew Bostovich, Boston University political scientist and historian. I think in many ways his critiques parallel Chomsky's, but he doesn't have the same kind of reputation for exaggeration and simplification that seems to dog Chomsky.
Mm. And I thought it was interesting in your book, Chomsky's Challenge to American Power, Tony Greco, you say, you refer to political philosopher Isaiah Berlin, who says the world is full of hedgehogs and foxes. This may be illustrative. You say Chomsky is a hedgehog. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I don't know why Berlin chose the hedgehog as his metaphor. But in any case, he meant that a hedgehog is a creature who knows one big thing. He has one fixed idea, and that's what he applies to his understanding of the world. And I think that fits Chomsky. Basically, his big idea is that American power, driven by capitalist greed, is responsible for much of the ills of the world. Now, as I think that there's much truth to that. It's a useful way of looking at the world, but when it becomes your all-encompassing view of the world, then it's going to lead you into sort of a back alley. You're going to miss nuances. You're going to miss the complexity of world affairs, and I think that's the case with Chomsky.
Again, you're listening to the Bert Cohen Show. Our guest is Anthony Greco, author of Chomsky's Challenge to American Power. The mainstream media these days, the right calls it liberal. They refer to the liberal media. The left calls it corporate run. How would Chomsky define the mainstream media, do you think, these days? Is he dismissive of it, do you think?
I don't know that Chomsky has used a simple label. I think probably the corporate media would certainly, that label would fit his analysis. He sees the mass media as basically serving the needs of American business, oriented right. towards ratifying our assumptions about the rightness of both American foreign policy and American capitalism. His main book on the media was Manufacturing Consent, published in the mid-1980s, or late 1980s, in which he really focused on foreign policy. And I think that book has been its findings have been confirmed by the subsequent quarter century of political science research on the media and foreign policy. Most scholars who've really looked at the issue will say that, yes, the media basically were echo chambers for Washington in the area of foreign policy. The foreign policy consensus in Washington tends to set the parameters of understanding of the issues.
Yeah.
So it was a pioneering work, and I think... a lot of the scholars who follow Chomsky didn't give him credit for his contribution, I think.
Yeah, the media just being a mouthpiece for the power in power. How much influence, real influence, do you, Tony, think Chomsky actually has had on mainstream discourse, discussion on U.S. foreign policy? What about his influence on actual American foreign policy or the direction of the left? He's wanted to be influential. Clearly, that it seems clear that he is committed to shape the prevailing ideology. How much real influence has Chomsky had, do you think?
It's a tough question. I should say that I don't really try to answer that question in my book. In my book, I really try to stick to looking at his writings and you know, assessing them on their merits, rather than asking how influential he's been. I can certainly try to answer your question
sure.
in a sort of impressionistic way. And I think that Chomsky hasn't really been that influential. I certainly, if you look at his prominence in the media, or his lack of prominence in the
right.
media, there's very little evidence that he has been accepted into the mainstream of discourse. He remains still out there on the left.
Hmm.
Whether he has sort of been influential through sort of like osmosis, you can speculate about that. But I tend to think not. I think he has a following on the left, and he's influential with that following. But what impact it's had on the broader policy discourse is very hard to say. I tend not to think it has been a great impact.
Yeah, it's interesting when the media looks for a voice on the left, they don't go very far left. That's for sure.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the left, seems to extend maybe a little bit to the left of center.
I guess. Well, there were those who actually called Barack Obama left.
Of course, yes.
I don't know what they're talking about, really.
It all depends on your on your perspective. If you're far enough off to the right, then even the center looks left.
That I know. I mean, it's kind of a mess. But when you look at who Noam Chomsky really is, he's not a socialist. I would think it's accurate to describe him as an intellectual anarchist, not for anarchy, but for anarchism. I think that is true. And somebody who reads my posts wrote this, and I'd be curious as to your reaction. This person wrote, "Noam Chomsky reminds me of what libertarians were when they were sane." Your reaction?
Well, it's possible. You have to be careful about the use of these terms.
Of course.
I think American libertarians are really very, very different from Chomsky, and I think Chomsky has pointed this out also. Libertarians basically want a government-free world, but it would be a world in which private markets and corporations were pretty much dominant. And Chomsky calls corporations private tyrannies. The kind of libertarian view of the world that we think of when we think of libertarianism is very, very different from Chomsky's perspective. He doesn't want private tyrannies to rule any more than he wants government tyrannies to rule. He calls himself sometimes a libertarian socialist, and sometimes he calls himself an anarchist. Basically, he is extremely critical of structures of authority and thinks that an ideal society would be one in which they were broken down. He has a vision of a society it's a sort of vague vision, because he says we can't foresee the future. We don't know exactly how things would develop. But it's certainly a society in which there would be a lot of structure, necessarily. He doesn't believe in anarchy. Anarchism
right.
and doesn't apply anarchy.
Right.
But it would be structures of participatory democracy rather than the kind of rigidly hierarchical bureaucracy that we have in government and in the private sector as well.
It sounds like the way you just described it, that his underlying philosophy, participatory democracy, really is kind of conservative in a real sense, very traditional with a lot of American history. My sense is that Chomsky believes that our foreign policy should be driven by a deep commitment to moral conviction. Do you see his definition of morality in foreign policy as being consistent with traditional Western ethics?
Oh, that's a tough question.
I try.
I think that I'm not sure what traditional Western ethics in foreign policy is. I mean, the sort of prevailing theories of foreign policy emphasize power and the need to not be terribly concerned with morality. And Chomsky certainly doesn't believe that. He believes that foreign policy needs to be motivated by a strong moral grounding.
Yeah, and I would think it's consistent with a lot of, you know, traditional Western morality and Western ethics. I can imagine his reaction to the phrase American exceptionalism. What do you think he would say about American exceptionalism?
Oh, he has said a lot. And in fact, long before that phrase became sort of popular, I think he was a critic of American exceptionalism long before people even used the phrase. He doesn't believe, most of his career, in fact, I think you could say, has been an attack on the myths of American exceptionalism, the belief that this country is inherently good and benign and has a special role to play in the world based on its ethics and its moral grounding. These beliefs are particularly popular on the right today, you know, among neoconservatives and others on the far right. But I think in more sophisticated formulations, they pervade our political culture. Even relatively sophisticated people, even liberals,
yes.
Even you know, intellectuals and journalists, tend to assume that we, America, are good and our enemies are bad,
right.
And that we mean well and we want to do well in the world, even if we don't always succeed. And Chomsky argues that that's basically a default assumption that isn't justified by the historical record, that we have often done bad, and you mustn't just give our leaders a pass on the basis of the assumption that, after all, we're trying to do good.
Yeah, it's been interesting to me how many liberals accept and embrace the notion of American exceptionalism. Our own governor of the state of New Hampshire shocked me. I mean, she's a Democrat, somewhat of a liberal, and she really thoroughly embraces the notion of American exceptionalism. That kind of surprises me. And I have to say, over the years, since the Vietnam War, sometimes I've fantasized about Chomsky actually in power, maybe as Secretary of State. What would America's foreign policy be if Noam Chomsky were in charge? Would it serve our interests better, do you think, Tony?
Well, again, you know, it depends on how you define our interests. I think Chomsky's foreign policy would be much less interventionist. We wouldn't be meddling. We wouldn't have an empire of military bases around the world. We would save a lot of money. We would be much more modest in our foreign policy goals. We would be much more willing. Chomsky points out how we tend to ignore treaties and assume that all sorts of international obligations don't apply to us because we're special. We're not
right.
An ordinary country.
Right.
We're not members of the International Criminal Court, for example.
Yeah, I know.
So Chomsky's foreign policy would be a much more restrained affair than what we have now.
Yeah, and I think with that foreign policy, we'd be investing more at home and taking care of our own needs, which then again, a lot of people on the right, I imagine, might actually agree with to do that. Do you think America has needed Noam Chomsky? How will his legacy be recorded in history? I know this is great speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Did we need Noam Chomsky, and how will his legacy be recorded, do you think, Tony?
Well, I think, again, what will history, you know, it depends in part on how history evolves. If in fact, we evolve in a direction that's more, consonant with Chomsky's ideas, then he might be remembered very, very favorably. And he might be remembered in the first
right.
place.
True.
If we maintain our present course, we continue to be an empire, if we continue to sort of exalt private markets over public needs, then Chomsky might just be a relatively minor footnote.
Yeah. And again, he's wanted to really influence foreign policy. And I have to ask this. There's a quote from him. Jingoism, racism, fear, religious fundamentalism. These are the ways of appealing to people if you're trying to organize a mass base of support for policies that are really intended to crush them. The allegedly, and that's the end of quote, the allegedly oppressed working class, has Chomsky resonated or connected with and empowered them at all? Has he connected at all with the working class?
Again, it's hard to discern the connections. I think that Chomsky was, for example, an object of interest by the Occupy movement. I think he was an inspiration to the Occupy movement.
Good point.
A couple of books by Chomsky were in the Occupy library, the original Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
So certainly there's some resonance of his ideas on the left. I think a lot of public radio stations and progressive groups, are aware of his ideas and have been influenced by him to some extent.
But the working class, again, it's
not something I've tried to understand systematically. So I'm just sort of giving you an impressionistic reaction here.
Has he seen your book?
I don't know. I hope he will.
It'll be interesting to see how he reacts. Yeah. The book is called Chomsky's Challenge to American Power, and it's put out by Vanderbilt University Press. The author is Anthony Greco. Thanks very much for being with us. Very, very informative and interesting discussion today. Thanks for being with us, Tony.
Thank you. I'm
Though nothing will keep us together.